Okay, I'd like to extend a very warm welcome to everybody who's come today, and particularly to our main speaker, Dr. Ben Anderson from Durham University. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Gillian Rose, and I'm going to be chairing this afternoon, as well as making a small contribution to the event. What's going to happen this afternoon is that I'm going to give a brief introduction to the seminar series, to this seminar series and to this particular seminar. And I'm going to introduce the two other speakers. Ben is then going to speak for about 40 to 45 minutes on some of his current research on affect future. I knew I'd get that wrong. Futurity and terror. Steve is then going to talk for much shorter length of time, probably around 10 minutes, reflecting on how the terms affect and emotion have been put to work in contemporary human geography. And then for another 10 minutes or so, I'm going to talk about some of the empirical material that's been generated by the project on Milton Keynes that some of you will be familiar with. Talk a bit about affect in Milton Keynes. What I'd like to do is raising some questions about the usefulness of affect in relation to that work, and I hope that will then open out for a more general discussion about affect and spatiality. Okay, so this seminar is the second in a series which we've called Spatially Thinking. And it's part of the relaunch of the Geography Department's research seminar. One of the strengths of the department here has been its work on theorising space and spatiality. And I think one of the most interesting things for me about this series is it promises to offer somewhere where we can actually talk about different theorisations of space and spatiality. So that's going to involve a dialogue among us geographers, but also, I think it really, has also to involve a dialogue with the other disciplines that are also represented here. So I hope we'll be able to encourage that this afternoon. And I think that's particularly the case because, as I'm sure you all know, a lot of disciplines have been contributing to what Patricia Ticinito-Clough has called the affective turn, as it's been touching on the social sciences more broadly. Now, for some geographers, at least, and I think it's fair to include Ben in this, I think it's been Deleuze, Masumi, Spinoza and Merleau-Ponty probably are the key theorists that have helped theorise space in this geographical affective term. And they particularly emphasise space as an event, as a performative event, which always carries the potential for excess. Now, the previous seminar, which unfortunately I couldn't attend, but listening to the podcast, focused a good deal on a rather different kind of space and a different kind of spatial vocabulary. It was described as topological space. There was discussion of networks, scales, territories. And I think at one point, John Allen, who can't be here this afternoon, I'm afraid, explicitly distinguished that kind of discussion of space from what he called the Deleuzian take on space. So I think it's likely that this afternoon we'll be working through a rather different spatial vocabulary. Now, the space of effect, affect, is seen as what Nigel Thrift has called push. That is, it's a pre-personal, pre-individual field of events which performatively constitutes a particular assemblages of the human and the non-human, which are diagrammed into particular persistent constellations of encounter. I hope you're impressed with that. It's the one sentence definition of the thing. 10, I don't know.
11.
Six, probably. So the materiality of space is really crucial here in this work because it's the materiality of spaces, bodies, places and landscapes that's seen as the source of this kind of excess, this sense of an always already potential for things to happen otherwise. So we have here a geography that's continually in the making, one with this kind of sense of an inherent something extra, which might be a risk, a threat, an excitement, an enchantment, a possibility of something more, something doubling, something different, or always likely to happen. Now, this turn to effect has been part of a wider shift within geography, at least, towards what Nigel Thrift has called non-representational theory. And while Thrift has his own version of what that might be, there's also a range of other positions developing within the discipline, some of which are Deleuzian, as I've just touched on. But others, for example, are more inspired by the work of, let's say, Latour, Serre and Stengers. And the next seminar in this series, since we're very fortunate in having some of the leading exponents of that particular body of work within a discipline here in geography as well, the next seminar in this series will be exploring that particular way of spatially thinking. But there's also been a more explicitly sociological and feminist interest in the discipline in the emotional, which I guess is where I might place some of my own work. Now, in this other work as well, space is also performative and unstable. But the source of that instability is less the inherent nature of the material, I would say, which is an ontological claim, less grounded in the inherent nature of the material and more in the ongoingness of subjectivity. So we have a sense of subjects, people, doing and feeling all sorts of complex, ambivalent, uncertain, unthought stuff, often with other people and other things, which might produce a whole range of very extraordinary or actually very, very ordinary sorts of spaces. And Liz Bondy and Joyce Davidson have written, whether joyful or heartbreaking, emotion has the power to transform the shape of our life worlds, expanding or contracting, creating new fissures or textures we never expected to find. Now, both our speakers this afternoon have made really significant contributions to these developments, so it's a real pleasure to have them in the same room engaging with each other for an afternoon. Steve Pyle's work has for a long time been insisting to geographers that human subjectivity is messy, complex, ambivalent, and above all driven in large part, some of the time at least, by unconscious desires and drives. And he's been very clear what that does to space, to geography. It makes space a very problematic field, structured as much, for example, by fantasy as by what we might imagine to be reality. And Steve's work also raises important methodological questions, which I think might well be an issue we want to pursue perhaps in the discussion time afterwards, about how we as researchers relate to our research subjects in ways that we can neither fully control nor indeed be fully aware of. Now, Ben's work, too, has been absolutely central to the affective turn. Ben Anderson has worked consistently with notions of the emotional and the affective, trying to bring them together, in fact, which is really quite an unusual move within this work. In papers that engage with a range of events, everyday listening to music, nanoscience, and most recently exercises for planning what to do in the event of some terrible emergency. Now, Ben's work is fully engaged with Deleuze, but also, for example, with Ernst Bloch and Alfonso Lingis in the theoretical level. But one of the things I really appreciated is that it's always very carefully embedded in empirical work as well. And his work in particular on everyday boredom and hope has been really helpful in thinking through some of the things in relation to the Milton Keynes project. So it gives me really great pleasure to ask Ben this afternoon to talk to us on affect, futurity and time.
Okay, great. Thank you, Gillian, for the introduction. Thanks to the postgraduates for a really interesting discussion earlier, which ended with a discussion of the uncritical exuberance that surrounds Barack Obama, which we might like to pick up on later. That was very interesting. Okay, my comments today start from a very simple problem, or a very simple issue, that the turn to affect and emotion is caught up in attention. On the one hand, the affective turn, if you want to use that phrase, is entangled with numerous promises, often ways of understanding the genesis and maintenance of the relations that make up the cultural, directing attention to the conditions under which novelty is produced, while anticipating the goals and techniques that could compose new forms of cultural politics based on inducing, amplifying, and transmitting capacities to affect. And these promises all stem from a break that the affective turn announces, a break with the regulative idea of culture as signifying practices or a signifying system that the new cultural geography was organised around. But if the affective turn is promissory, it is simultaneously an imperative that follows from a recognition that forms of sovereign, governmental and biopower invest collectives as affect structures and individuals as affective beings, not necessarily to dampen the force of that affectivity, but precisely by working through the push of affect, precisely by working through the indeterminacy of spaces in the making. So as such, the interest in affectivity, caught up in these and other diverse promises and imperatives, can, I think, be understood as both a diagnostic for a set of contemporary conditions and potentially as a symptom of those same conditions. And so I want to approach this thing called the affective turn today without either vindication or denunciation, but as a necessary moment of possibility in geography and elsewhere. So, in this paper, I want to reflect on the turn to affect and emotion, the term turn being shorthand for nothing else but a deviation in our established sensibilities, concepts and theories in response to this swirl of promises and imperatives from a specific empirical starting point. ESRC-funded research on how exercises, live simulations of catastrophic or disastrous events that disrupt and thereafter disorder normal circulations and dependencies are used to secure life. How exercises are used to secure precisely the excess of the event. So, let's take one example of a particular exercise or a particular atmosphere that followed one exercise to give you a sense of what I'm interested in. In an exercise held in 2007, entitled Exercise Virus, Wolverhampton suffered the loss of its computer and telecommunications infrastructure due to a malicious virus. In what can only be described as unfortunate timing, a group of animal rights protesters choose the same day to release anthrax spores, first in Wolverhampton's university and second in a shopping complex. Or so a scenario went. In response to the advent of what we could call an event, and after a detailed scenario that describes the idiosyncratic movement of that particular advent into a crisis, the exercise involved approximately 12 agencies playing the response and recovery phase of the event, as well as actors pretending to be dead or injured. The exercise was designed to function effectively, to create a surprising event that would hold responders' attention and foster somehow a stressful experience. As soon as the event is over, as soon as the exercise is over, all traces of it and how it infused a set of public sites in Wolverhampton Centre disappear. Unlike the fixed architecture as a simulation, exercises have a kind of site-specific logic. A certain event is temporarily created through the arrangements of bodies and materials before it disappears again and life continues on. So exercises are one of a number of techniques for dealing with and handling the aleatory dynamics of events that have accompanied the rise of a set of specific anticipatory logics, preemption, precaution, preparedness, in the context of numerous calls to use the capacity of imagination in the face of a surprising or eventful future. Some more examples. Operation East Wind, a tabletop exercise that explored response to a no-notice terrorist dirty bomb that exploded on the A5 near the village of Marquette, 4 miles southeast of Luton. Exercise Flyer, a live, real-time, multi-agency exercise based on a maliciously released toxic chemical substance involving 400 responders and 200 members of the public playing casualties, held in Alton Towers car park. I particularly like that location, I've got to say. So day after day, everywhere from nondescript meeting rooms to the UK's number one leisure park for fantastical fun, here I'm quoting the website, it's not necessarily my own opinion of Alton Towers, the public sector rehearses disaster in order to secure circulations and the circulations and interdependencies that compose life. How then to think the relation between affect or emotion and insecurity? And how does this case provide an opportune occasion to reflect on that affective turn? The question gives us pause for thought because to use a slightly different notion of security of certitude, it's proved impossible as well as perhaps undesirable to secure the proper uses of the terms affect and emotion. My starting point when reflecting on the turn to affect and emotion, and I'm going to use the term affectivity to refer to both, it's kind of shorthand, is that any version of what affectivity is and does is mocked by the extraordinary proliferation of versions of what each are and do. If we take them as terms in Radenboe's sense of the juxtaposition of word, referent, object, concept, they proliferate. Multiple words used vaguely and interchangeably, mood, feeling, ambience, passion, affect, emotion, all of which have different etymologies, different everyday and specialist uses. Multiple empirical referent objects, focused involvements, lifelong dedications, punctual interruptions, ambient moods, collective atmospheres, fleeting bodily transformations. Multiple concepts that take their sense from their connection with other concepts. Emotion as a perception of bodily change, William James. Affect as pre-personal capacities to affect and be affected. Emotion as the self-difference in cognition, and so on. So the first point is that any theory of affect and emotion, and any attempt to work through that theory via an example of insecurity, must take care in how it does theory. Because the initial problem it confronts is far from an absence, far from a silencing of affectivity. The initial problem is the exact opposite, a constant proliferation of claims about what affect and emotion are, a constant set of explanations, descriptions, understandings of what they are and do. Let me put this differently. Our current theoretical innovation and invention around affect and emotion is not some kind of spontaneous event. In particular, it reminds us to be careful about the truth value of a theory of an affect and emotion and the exaggerated trust replacing that claim to secure a set of further claims. Whether securing calls for a return to an expressive subject who flexibly relates or refers to their world, or whether securing calls to attend to a pre-individual everydayness synonymous with everyday possibility. In short, and to summarise, I'm uncertain about how we should go on and theorise affect and emotion. And I want to persuade you this is a good thing at the moment. So my aim with this warning in mind is not then to offer a conception of affect and emotion, not to gain abject or objective matters of fact, but advocating a set of positions. I mean, there's too many positions that have been advocated in this debate, I think. But to open out a set of problematics for a theory of affect and emotion, and a set of questions that perhaps we can discuss after our three talks. So, the paper unfolds in three parts. Section one, a step back from specific types of security and discuss the necessary relation between affectivity and insecurity. Before, in section two, giving a little background to exercise as a specific technique. The remainder of the paper argues that exercises function through a certain mode of relation to the future that I'll call paranoid hopefulness. At various stages in this paper, I'll interrupt my account of our exercises here, pause and offer a series of broader reflections about the promises and imperatives that make up the affective-emotive term. Do this around two problematics. The problematic of structure, or how certain affects, emotions and so on cohere, and conditions, or what do singular affects and emotions do. So the first point, or wider point, I'd like to make, and I did one that's going to be a little bit clunky as I move from the empirical case to a set of wider points, is the need for some kind of differentiated conceptual vocabulary for affectivity. The task of conceptual invention being to offer a vocabulary that sensitises ourselves to the complexities of experience, that is, the extension, specificity and efficacy of singular affects, specific emotions and their interactions, and thus enables us to wonder again in our encounters with affectivity. And insecurity is, of course, inseparable from affectivity. Taken from Macmillan's word, the first meaning of security is this condition, the condition of being protected from or not exposed to danger, safety, or freedom from care, anxiety or apprehension. And here we can attend to differences in this condition of being secure. First, the shared atmospheres of security, spatially discharged quasi-objective capacities to affect and be affected. Second, to incorporate bodily feelings of security into the points of transactions or passages, whereby those feelings are qualified in determinate emotions that have a degree of narrative complexity. Consider contemporary terror. Rather than our present being inhabited by a culture of fear or an age of anxiety, both of which I think are very poor descriptive notions, I can talk in more depth why later. I think an atmosphere of indefinite vague threat saturates ordinary life. The atmosphere only occasionally surges up as those anxieties or fears become attached to particular racialised and gendered bodies. But that atmosphere is ambivalent precisely because of its distributed virtualities. Something about an atmosphere exceeds. An atmosphere is neither a possession of an object nor a projection of a subject. Atmospheres are everywhere and nowhere, distributed across bodies, but expressed and qualified differently. And they are both indeterminate and determinate, hovering at the edge of the sayable, yet the qualities we give to atmospheres are remarkable for their singular qualities. An atmosphere is serene, homely, erotic, terrifying, and so on. So as such, seeing the relationship between insecurity and affect in this first way as a condition, atmosphere raises the question of the structure of collective affects. If we presume that affectivity is not necessarily structured through some form of mediation whereby discourses or ideologies stand in between subject and world, atmosphere is a useful concept because it poses the problem of structures in solution, a set of elements with internal relations, both interlocking and intention, and it raises the necessary speculative character of some of our concepts around affectivity. But there is a second, different sense the word security has, a sense of unwarranted confidence, a culpable absence of anxiety, a carelessness. So again, cite Macmillan. Here the emphasis is on securing as a continuous process of making secure, an emphasis that disrupts the distinction between insecurity as a state of affairs and security as its negation, and opens up a definition of affect as vaguely dynamic modes of relation. Insecurity and security are imbricated in one another in more complex ways than the separation and opposition between security and insecurity would suggest. How then is securing, as distinct from security as condition, affective? The process of securing involves two moves, I would argue. First, securing involves disclosing and relating to the ingress of a dangerous supplement to the here and now. That supplement then determines action in the present. Its mode of action in that present is through fear, anxiety, and other forms of apprehension. A first supplement to the present, then, a danger. Secondly, security involves changing the thing secured, forcing or inducing it to undergo some form of transformation after it has been made susceptible to being secured, a process that makes present a valued future. A second supplement to the present, then, a promise. Hence the radical ambiguity of security. It is dependent on both a dangerous and promissory supplement that makes the present the past of a not-yet future. The necessary mode of relation to the future, then, is a certain organisation of hope. If by hope we understand nothing more, nothing less, than a relation in which life is tensed between the possible and actual, in the shadow of extant actual or possible damage or destruction. So, security works through two supplements, a dangerous and a promissory supplement. How then do exercises, as one specific technique, function to make present the dangerous and promissory supplement that would enable securing to take place? And how has hope come to be invested in exercise as in the context of those indeterminate, perhaps speculative atmospheres that now animate and haunt the contemporary around terror and other crises and contingencies? The question opens up a second problem, in addition to the problem of structure of affectivity for theory of affect and emotion. But this question hints to how techniques of power harness and inform the aleatory indeterminate dynamics of affectivity. Affect is neither a pure outside synonymous with a creativity that power is doomed to miss, nor the authentic expressed of a subject, but median and object for different forms of power that exceed manipulation. One political problem regarding affect, of course not the only one, is how to understand the imbrication between a multiplicity of techniques and the multiplicity that is affectivity, without assuming that power either represses or misses. So, exercises are one such technique that harness and work through affectivity. They are currently used as part of security as a mode of power in the context of calls to foster and harness techniques of imagination in order to know the future. The problem of the future in relation to the present has become one of indeterminacy. The future presents itself as a surprise that will disrupt and thus disorder life, but in ways in which the degree and scope of disorder are not knowable. In relation then to the surprise of the future, the fear is of belatedness, that action will always already be too late when faced with events of terror. The response is not to be fatigued or indolent in the face of the future, but to be enthralled to the imagination, to govern terror and other events, crisis and contingency, by inventing, formalising and deploying an extraordinary range of techniques through which futures are named and known, Delphi exercises, forecasting and so on. One of the most interesting moves in IR at the moment is a whole series of people who are doing work, disentangling and working through these different techniques of imagination and how they function, including someone in the audience today, I think. Claudia, I might be right. Exercises are one such technique for imagination. They are simultaneously training exercises based on a form of experiential knowing, tests of existing response and recovery plans, and labs to generate future knowledge. We could say to begin with that we can think of exercises as experiments, both procedures of validation and ways of opening to newness. Or even more precisely, we could say that an exercise event is a demonstration, in that it points to the significance of a named event and demonstrates the providential role of the state in relation to that named event. Exercises are then sites of imperfect coordination in which various distributor state and non-state actors momentarily coalesce into a singular totality with a providential relation to the circulation and independencies that make up life. That sentence sounded shorter when I last went through it last time. The event acts as the catalyst for that gathering movement, that momentary gathering together. The use of exercises in a UK emergency plan has three direct antecedents. I want to touch on them because they show how exercises function to make futures present affectively, but not only affectively. First, civil defence rehearsals, beginning in the Second World War. Here, compliance with civil defence is performative. The pre-attack and escalation phases of war are performed as if they are happening, and as such, had numerous well-documented side effects that people like Pete Addy have written about. Increased panic disorders, contagious fears, etc. Second, war gaming. In the context of the Cold War, war games, here a war game is valorised for how it generates an anticipatory experience of war through the play of the game. Third, the exercise. The political exercise. I absolutely love this photo, if for no other reason than the huge fish at the top. the title for this is, I can't remember exactly what it's title of the is something like, RAND strategists discuss the aftermath of a catastrophic nuclear war in America. I just love the juxtaposition between that and the topic. So, the political exercise, this being one, was described as a laboratory for political inventiveness that posed a problem and explored various solutions. It was commended for how it enabled an experimentation in the realm of policy to cultivate an atmosphere of relaxation. Note the sitting down. Although they're all still wearing suits, it's not actually that relaxed, perhaps for RAND strategists. I can talk in more depth about the background to these three different techniques and how they function to make futures present through a certain organisation of affectivity, but there's some differences between them. I can talk in more depth if people would like to. So all three techniques share a problem because of their orientation to the event. A problem of how to establish a relation between a future event that disrupts or disorders society and the bounded site of an exercise, game or simulation. How to establish a relation between the event of a catastrophic nuclear war and that room. The problem is more precisely a problem of realism. how to make present a future event that has not previously been experienced. We could pose the question differently. How to understand the possible or actual conditions for the emergence of the panic, the anticipatory experience, or relaxation that imbue these different antecedents to exercises, when so much thinking around affect has been thinking of the moment or instance of spontaneity. In the minimum sense, the affect signals that something new has emerged or erupted in a particular situation. How to think the conditions for affect, in addition to how to think the structure of affect. Let's take one example from the prehistory of strategic gaming to see how an atmosphere, in this case a tensed, quasi-objective collective feeling shared by participants but bounded in a particular site, is assembled as the solution to the problem of realism. In their simplest forms, war games involved individuals playing a role and responding to events on the basis of that role. Here Herman Kahn and Ivor Mann, RAND strategists, offer a rationale for gaming that adds nuance to the orientation to the future event by reflecting on the predictive value of the minimum rule or tabletop war game. A game does not portray the future. The reason for this is, first of all, an obvious one. The future is uncertain. More than that, it is clear that some very improbable events are sure to occur, and some of these improbable events will have important effects. By their very nature, it is impossible to take into account these improbable events. Now, if people hear an echo here of a famous quote by an ex-defense secretary of the US, you'll be corrected, because Rumsfeld actually worked under Herman Kahn for a period of time. Herman Kahn being one of the key strategists of deterrence in the early Cold War. I can talk more about him if necessary. So during the period of their development in the 50s and 60s, what was assumed to unite political and military games was that they enable unknown events to be felt. This was described as an anticipatory experience or a synthetic experience, and was likened to the immersive limit of art or games. In one of Herman Kahn's books, Thinking About the Unthinkable, there's a terrific discussions that, of the role of novels could play in imagining future events in nuclear war. In addition to possibilistic prediction, there's a discussion of novels, there's a discussion of role-playing in general, and there's a discussion of the theatre. The atmosphere of a game, then, has a doubled status. It has a tendency to introduce artificiality and must therefore be regulated with rules and norms. So there's a whole series of regulations and norms that go into the composition of any atmosphere. Where to place flags, how long to keep the two sides who play each other in a war game apart from one another, so they wouldn't talk and discuss previous strategies. Who to get to play the enemy in a war game. Who would be able to inhabit the mind of the enemy. So analysts give examples of games where the atmosphere has played a causal role in generating, to quote, strange and unpleasant possibilities that were more far-fetched and gloomy than otherwise if the atmosphere had been different. But it's also through the atmosphere of a game that strategic game is able to establish a relation with possible events. As designing a designated atmosphere is meant to, and to quote Herman Kahn again, make the analysis less icily rational, to give it explicitly colour, emotion, accent, irrationality, and so forth. So contemporary exercises share this problematic that atmospheric modulation was the solution to. The problem of securing events that have not and may never happen. And they share a response to produce a certain sort of affective rather than mimetic realism, which atmosphere becomes the means of securing. So to go back to the questions of the conditions of these atmospheres, we've seen two possible conditions that are more or less mutable. That is, somehow they continue. An indeterminate atmosphere of threat that calls forth the use of techniques of imagination, and the emergence and descent of exercise as a technique. Here, affect is not only on the side of the eventual dynamic of life, but is organised and organising. So let's return to the Wolverhampton example, to show how exercises grasp and handle the problem of the event, and affectivity is conditioned in certain ways. Any specific exercise begins by naming a future event. This is important. Naming an event, in Wolverhampton example, a bioterrorist anthrax attack, is both a referential and evocative act, a name functioning to individuate within a line of descent, as Denise Riley puts it. So bioterrorist anthrax attack carries with it and reactivates in the present the remains of a series of terror as well as fears of a mutating bios. But perhaps there is also an element of the strange magic we sometimes give to wishful naming, a naming that would ward off dangers and avert crises. So let's look at some of the ways in which the exercise event stages the affective realism of events in the hope of warding off danger, in the hope of ensuring immunity from a disorder that threatens. First, the punctual event of the event is coming to pass, is staged. A scenario, a term with theatrical origins, establishes an artificial start point for the exercise. The event comes We can know no more about it than this. Unlike in civil defence rehearsals mentioned above, there is no pre-attack or escalation phase. The event happens. This is all that can be known about either modern accidents or malicious acts. It arrives. But the scenario, any scenario, bears the weight of its accumulative repeats. A scenario focused on anthrax resurrects and reactivates old dramas, dramas of terror, dramas of a mutating bias. But it does more. Scenarios function to set up action, providing a formulaic structure that predisposes certain outcomes, but also allows for play. Second, the immediate effects of the event are staged. Immediate destruction is staged through the arrangement of materials and bodies. People pretend to be dead and injured. Actors cry, volunteers scream. Hence, a specific bound of time and space for the play of the exercise is assembled. A scene is set within which the subsequent action will unfold. Third, moving from the advent to how a specific possible event unfolds across the dynamics of interdependencies and circulations. A milieu, the scenario stages a milieu through which the event will unfold post its occurrence, post its coming to pass. The scenario describes of a series of events post the initial event, a series of accumulating units that are affected by that event, and a series of mobile elements, flows, money, etc., that will be disrupted. It describes a milieu, to use Foucault's terms. An exercise controller or an umpire, in addition, stages various acts of nature at random, unpredictable junctures during the exercise to give a sense of the unruly dynamics of the event as it unfolds post an advent. Fourth and following on, the experiential dynamic, the atmosphere of the event, as it would affect those charged with response and recovery stage. This occurs in part through the arrangement of bodies and materials in the exercise site, the trick being to stimulate the urgency felt during emergency response. But it also occurs as the exercise play occurs, in particular through the composition of stressful conditions that would enable the pressure events to be felt. And there are various techniques for producing stress. One is to increase stress by making decisions time-limited and releasing information regarding the unfolding events at certain stages. Another is to carefully script the rhythm and duration of play to avoid boredom in participants. So the exercise event establishes a relation with a future contingency, or emergent through the placement, a deliberate arrangement, that establishes the exercise event as a juncture, a meeting place between the future and present. So the first suggestion I'd make about exercises is that we can think about them as theatrical happenings. Of course, the first link is obvious. Exercise provide a medium to observe a possible future event, in the sense of theatre from the Greek theatre. But exercise has also established the effect of theatricality, the establishment of a real immediate physical presence for what has not and may never happen. The exercise event is then already doubled, already dislocated. A future event in the Wolverhampton case, an anthrax attack, is both here and now and elsewhere or else when. Here the act of staging produces a minimum difference, a new combination of unfolding event acquires a natural milieu that adds something to the world. This is neither fantastical, an illusion, nor simply a repetition of the present. A minimum difference is introduced. And if we consider for a moment how many of these specific possible events are staged, we get the sheer extent of dangerous supplements being summoned forth. Dangerous supplements have become part of a series of actual or potential events, a series that, as Brian Massumo writes, engulfs and exceeds the occasions when actual danger materialises. So one of the questions we want to ask in the research is, how thereafter does this ever-expanding series feed back into the atmospheres that surround terror and other threats to life, and ensure that that atmosphere does not fade, but somehow remains close to the surface of life, primed to be qualified and expressed once it's recatalysed? But there is something else at work here. Exercises have a promissory structure. They're not only about establishing a dangerous supplement. Exercises promise immunity by ensuring that there can never be any bad surprises. The mode of relation is a paranoid one, structured around an anticipatory hyperactivity that discloses an ever-expanding series of bad surprises. The result is a spatial and temporal shift. The here and now becomes the past of a future that may not happen. This leads to a second problem for those charged with securing the event. How to end an event. Not how to have love for an event, not how to affirm an event, but how to end an event. Staging is insufficient to answer this question because the event exceeds. This means that the now staged as if event must be played for a limited duration, in either real or artificial time, within the arranged exercise space. The medium, the combination of elements that compose the exercise, is inhabited through more or less open-ended forms of action. So let's look at some of these types of action, enable the exercise to anticipate the scope of the event, how an event endures, and how an event can thereafter end. The first set of acts involve explicit pretense. in the sense of people inhabiting roles which are explicitly out of the ordinary. So actors drawn from local amateur dramatic groups, casualty unions or groups with particular skills, pretend to be dead or pretend to be injured. They're instructed on how to do this. And I can talk a little bit more about this if people would like to. An exercise controller, an umpire, pretends to be the event itself and responds to the actions and decisions of the participants, or to pretend to be what is generally termed contingency or nature. Here, I don't think pretending is quite the same as performing, necessarily. The second type of action revolves around a participation in the as-if event through the deliberate movements of the different individuals and organisations that would respond to that event, emergency services and so on, both in terms of physical movements within the space and expressive acts such as decisions. And we can say that a whole series of emotions and feelings are integral to the taking place of the exercise as an event itself, in the sense that it is a specific occurrence in a more or less bounded site with its limited duration. We could also say, for example, that something like the collective atmosphere of the event is central to the reality effect of the exercise in a way that individual emotions aren't necessarily. The worst thing an exercise can be is boring, as boredom menaces the ability to offer instantaneous decisions under conditions of stress. If the world offers nothing, if it doesn't open itself up to possibility, then all pretense is lost. People remember they are pretending. The third type of action is that the exercise event is witnessed by monitors or observers who inhabit set areas within the exercise but do not participate in it. Instead, they bear witness to it, and through them, knowledge of the event is codified and circulates in materiality such as debrief reports and after-action reports. But the lessons of acts of witnessing the event is always and invariably of a gap between present capabilities and resiliences and the disordering future event. Witnessing the play of an event is to witness failings, oversights, partialness. It is to witness the excess of the event over present capabilities. And it is to witness thereafter a dangerous supplement, the unruly dynamics of the event. The exercise does not therefore simply ensure an event does not come to pass, but generates a minimal gap between what has been rehearsed and what could come to pass. The minimum difference of events that the literary theorist Shan Nagai terms stuplemity, a combination of boredom and shock. So, what I've offered today is, if you like, an analysis of genre, in many ways. An analysis of the genre of exercises. The ESRC grant involves a series of ethnographies of these different exercises. A series of processes of following the design of specific exercises, and a series of interviews with individuals and organisations involved in the design of these exercises. So my initial hypothesis, together with Pete Addy and Steve Graham, who the grant is with, is that exercises are events of experimentation and demonstration that generate the dangerous and promissory supplement of security through a disjunctive synthesis of naming, staging, playing and witnessing. The future is therefore suspended between a hoped-for future in which the event disrupts but does not disorder, and a disastrous future in which the event disrupts and does disorder. So the present is suspended between two different futurities. Securing depends on this work of transforming the here and now into the past of this not-yet future, a not-yet future which is itself suspended between two or more outcomes. So, I've realised, as speaking, that the affect and emotion dimension of this talk is fairly far in the background. So, first of all, my slight apologies for that, although you're meant to never apologise for anything when speaking. What I wanted to do is draw out five different problematics. This paper kind of sits between that ESRC research on exercises and a monograph I'm trying to write, entitled, rather dramatically, Spaces of Affect and Emotion. I need to find a better title. But I've tried to draw out, if you like, five problematics that, if you like, were kind of could be posed as opening discussion points. First of all, affectivity, and what after Foucault I'm describing really simply is the repressive hypothesis. The hypothesis that because of the unsayable nature of affect or emotion, we have somehow never spoken about affect or emotion. I think the exact opposite is the case. Obviously, there's distinctions between how we're phrasing this repressive hypothesis, perhaps we can talk about. Secondly, the question that I posed to you about the necessity or not of a differentiated vocabulary for understanding affectivity. What does that differentiated vocabulary enable us to attune to? If we suspend claims that we are simply describing matters of fact. So what work does any kind of differentiated vocabulary do for us? Thirdly, and in some ways the problematic of the ESRC research, the problem of the relationship between different forms and modalities of power and affect has in certain writings, Hart and Negri, Masuma to a lesser extent, been posed as a problem of the continual escape of affect from techniques of manipulation. And of therefore a kind of antagonism between affect as constitutive and power as a kind of constitutive, a reactive moment. For me, the problematic is somewhat different. The problematic is the relationship between, if you like, an immeasurable excess of different techniques of power and the immeasurable excess of affectivity, and how in any given situation different forms of power and different forms of activity come together or not. But then that follows two further questions. Which in some ways are a break or a kind of disruption with the kind of like eventual focus of most of the literature on affect, or the use of affect to act as a kind of term that describes the moment of indetermination within sociality. Affect is that which is disruptive somehow to its pre-existing conditions, which is why NRT has been kind of obsessed with dance and play, and is kind of precisely about this kind of like moment of kind of spontaneous invention in many ways. My question is different. I'm interested in the notion of atmosphere precisely because it forces to ask the question of how are collective affects structured in ways that are precisely through a kind of tension between determinacy and indeterminacy, sayability, non-sayability, specificity and inexactness, if you like. And so I'm kind of interested in the notion of atmosphere, partly because it forces us to be speculative in the notion of, in our concepts, and so kind of process conceptual invention from that, but precisely because it poses this problem of how is affect structured. But then secondly, and slightly differently, we've had various notions to account for how affectivity is structured, you know, kind of like the notion of infrastructure, you know, the notion of affective episteme, notions of kind of structures of feeling, notions of ideology, emotional ideologies, discourse of emotion, etc., etc. But then secondly, conditions, and how to understand the articulation between different kind of signifying and asignifying conditions across different emergences of different affects or emotions. But I'll leave it there. Thanks for listening.